hello and welcome to episode 101 of the 1099 for the week of July 17th, 2017. I am your host, Josiah Renauden, and with me today is a game designer and writer for Divinity Original Sin 2, Earth Knight, and a medley of other games, as well as my former editor at GameSpot, Kevin Van Orden. Kevin, how are you doing today?
Would it be okay? I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, Josiah, but I was really curious if we could call this episode the wonderful 101 episode, or would that... I didn't even know it was number 101 until literally just now when you said it, so...
I think I have to call it that now, because I didn't even think about the... I totally forgot what episode number it was, because I backload these, record them way in advance, but yeah, now I will 100% call it that.
Excellent.
It'll be the sequel we've been waiting for to that game. Thanks for coming on. It's been a while. Like, last time we talked, you had just gotten the Tryon Worlds job. You were still in California, pretty freshly out of GameSpot, which feels so long ago.
It feels like forever ago, yeah.
I mean, because now you're in Belgium working for Larian Studios, and, you know, which is on one of your favorite games, Divinity Original Sin 2. At least you loved the original one. Let's start here. How has the actual move been? Because I know, like, Dutch, French, and German are the major languages. But
yeah.
Are you kind of just winging it in English? Are you picking stuff up?
The good news is everybody speaks English, basically. So there are three regions of Belgium, essentially. There's the Dutch-speaking region, which is Flanders, which is where I live. I live in the city of Ghent, which is in East France. It's in Flanders. There's the French-speaking portion, and then there's there's the German sliver in the East, basically. It's very rare that I actually come across German speakers, and of course, being in Flanders, I'm more or less surrounded by Dutch speakers, but everybody speaks English. So, except a very few, so you can get by. And of course, everybody at Larian speaks English, because Larian is an incredibly cosmopolitan group of people from around the world. And so, and plus, we have studios not just in Belgium, but we have offices in Canada, in Ireland, and in Russia.
Jeez.
So we've got people in different offices, and English is the language that binds us together, as it were.
How big is the studio overall? Like, how many employees are at Larian?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, we're small, but we're big small. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
we're on that cusp where I think if we were any bigger, I think we'd have to sort of have a restructuring. But I don't know. Like, Sven Vinka is our CEO and basically the puppet master of it all. And he does a really great job of it, but I can't imagine being in his shoes, because I don't know when he sleeps. And I think if we were any bigger than we are, I think we would reach that point where I don't know how he would do it. We'd have to add more hours to the day for him, for us to, like, sort of be structured the way we are. But I don't know. He's sort of a mad genius.
Yeah, I can only imagine when you have, like, that many locations you're trying to juggle, where you have to kind of be up at all times. Like, of course, he's not, like, heading every single spot, but he has to have some sort of influence in all of it.
Oh yeah, totally.
So I think it's funny. When I first moved to Florida, I remember everyone immediately is like, oh, how many times have you been to Miami? Even though I'm in Jacksonville, it's not even close. I bet it's similar for you when you move to where you are now in Belgium. I'm going to ask you, have you had a chance to travel to any other countries around you, like France or Germany or anything like that? Or am I a crazy person when I say that?
You're not a crazy person. Here's the thing. Like, the United States is, like, Europe-sized. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's continent-sized. And so when you move to Europe, the first thing that struck me is how small like, Belgium is small anyway. Like, we're the size of New Jersey, basically.
Oh,
and so you have a whole country, you know, in that little space. And so you can't help, but you almost end up going to other countries just by nature. And it's very easy because, you know, we're in the EU. So you can go essentially anywhere. And, you know, I've still got my American passport, of course. So as long as I'm not in the place wherever it is that I go for longer than 90 days, I can do whatever. So, I've been to Ireland a couple times now, for Larian business. But I haven't ventured outside of Belgium, but that's changing because in November, which is sort of about a month and a half after, Original Sin 2's release, I'll be going on a little vacation in Portugal. I'm going to Lisbon.
Oh, it's amazing.
So that'll be really nice. And I keep meaning to go to some of these places. The problem is that now we're in crunch. So yeah. it's hard to find the time to do anything really spectacular, but I would really like to at least get away for the weekend and go to Paris. And of course, Brussels is in Belgium. So I've been to, but I haven't even really done anything in Brussels because it's the place where the airport is. So that's really the only thing I've done. And in Belgium, I've been to Antwerp and, I've been to, Bruges. And, that's kind of it aside from sort of the Ghent region. But Ghent in and of itself is very beautiful and very historic. And unlike a lot of other cities, it wasn't really bombed to smithereens at any point. Mm-hmm. So its oldness is very intact, I guess is a way of putting that. And so it's a nice tourist town, the kind of place that you go where you want to do touristy things, but you want to avoid the really mainstream stuff. Mm-hmm. Like that's what Ghent is. Or I should say Ghent. Like if I'm going to be really, really, well, here's the other thing. Like we speak Dutch sort of. But really we speak Flemish, the Flemish variant of Dutch, which is its own dialect sort of. I mean, if you speak Dutch, you know, regular Dutch, Netherlands Dutch, everybody's going to understand you. But there's also a lot of differences in pronunciation and structure and, you know, that sort of thing. So
do you at all feel like a tourist at this point? Like, or has this now 1 year mark kind of made you feel like all right, I now belong in this area?
Well, I do have these moments, where I'm walking down the street. And so just my walk to work alone takes me through city center, past Gravenstein, which is a castle, like it's just a big old grand castle right in the middle of the city. Yeah. And then I keep going down and then there's a little teeny castle, like literally right next door to the office. And I cross canals that when the sky is blue and the sun is out, just glistening and gorgeous. And I have these moments where I'm like, oh shit, I live here, you know, and sort of in a way that I didn't have even in other places in the US. Like it's really easy to take for granted where you live if you live there. Like I lived in the DC area and I lived in San Francisco and you live in places like that. And sometimes you realize that you're sort of taking it for granted.
Yeah.
The cool things. But after a while, San Francisco did lose its charm. I think it's a city in the process of losing its charm very quickly, for a lot of reasons. And so it sort of, the timing was right. And it was sort of a refreshing start. And you sort of have to, another cool thing is you have to relearn all the little things. Like you come to a new country and suddenly things change, like how light switches work and whether you push or pull the door. And I know this all seems like silly stuff, but you're constantly being bombarded by these little teeny things that you always think you understand because they've always been one way. And now suddenly you're forced to think about things like light switches and doorknobs and ATMs and all these things that are different. Like I'll give you a good example is pharmacies. So in the US, especially when you live in a city like San Francisco, just go to Walgreens or Rite Aid or whatever, which are open insane hours of the day, and you just go and you buy whatever you want. Or you just go to the grocery store or to the corner store or wherever to get Tylenol or Benadryl or, you know, shelves full of 7 dozen types of antacids, right?
Yeah.
That doesn't exist here. You don't buy medicine anywhere but a pharmacy. And a pharmacy is a tiny little place that you go and you tell the pharmacist what you need and then they get it for you. Even if it's an over-the-counter thing like Tylenol. And, you know, like you go and it's not like there are 17 brands of ibuprofen. You go and you get the one brand of ibuprofen and it's what you get. And it's more expensive and it's much more, it's much more regulated, I guess. And so, like, one of the things I, you know, I'm going to do, because I'm going to go home for Christmas. I'm going to go home to Pennsylvania for Christmas. And I'm definitely going to buy like a big bottle of Benadryl and a big bottle of ibuprofen and a big bottle of, you know, big bottles of a few other things so that I have them, so that I can sort of avoid the Belgian hassle. But the good thing about that is that you don't end up having like that moment where you're blinded by choice all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of interesting. You got to get used to it. Plus, Sunday comes, for example, and all the pharmacies are closed. So they all trade off when somebody's going to be open on Sunday. So if I say I come down with a cold on Saturday night and I really want to go get some cold medicine, that ends up being a deal. It's not just a trip to Walgreens to buy cold medicine and to choose from the 20 million kinds that they have on the shelf. It's looking online to see which pharmacies are open so that I know which one to go to, and then dealing with the crabby person at the counter who doesn't want to be working on Sunday. And then, because that's another thing you get used to, is like that sort of the hours of everything. I mean, they take work-life balance really seriously here. So grocery stores close, you know, restaurants close. You go to a place and you discover that they're closed for an hour and a half for lunch. And then you discover that they have weird hours where they're open, you know, Mondays, Wednesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays, and they're closed on different days. And the reason for that is, of course, that they actually, you know, for example, like a 38-hour work week is the norm here. And anything over that is basically, you know, no, you don't do that.
Wow.
So it's, you know, we have Nachtwinkels, which is like sort of a corner store that you go to at night, whether for liquor or whatever. So we still have those, but, you know, those are, you know, that's what you have to go to at night. There's no other option. You don't go shopping in at nighttime. And then that's insane. Everything's on holiday, and soon begins Hensefesten, which is basically, which stands for like the Ghent feast, basically. It's the big, 2 weeks worth of partying. People in Belgium love to party, and they love their festivals. Every weekend there's a festival somewhere. You go walking and you just come across, like, it's just like in the square, there's a shit ton of people and kids on a carousel, and they've put up decorations, and there's like every weekend you go and there's like food stands. You know, like when you go out and like there's a block party somewhere in town.
Mm-hmm.
It's like that all the time here.
That sounds exhausting.
But it's also wonderful. The bad news is that because I live right in the center of town, it's loud.
Yeah.
So there's not really many big thoroughfares going through the town, but I live on one of the bigger streets. So it's Sint Jacobs Nieuwstraat, which is me trying to sound Dutchy. So
you convinced me.
I don't know very much of the language yet. I'm hoping to learn, but it's hard because I have to go to work, and then I don't really make the time to be learning the language when I'm not working. So anyway, that's a long version of Belgium's cool, and you have a lot to get used to that's new.
I know you are in crunch now, but you mentioned that work-life balance being taken very seriously. Like, do you have longer lunches than you ever had at GameSpot? And just, again, you said 38-hour weeks. Is there sometimes even less than that? Do you sometimes have like a 30-hour week? Because
that doesn't really happen. No. Okay. That, well, I mean, most game designers will tell you that when it comes to making games, it ends up always being a little bit different than you'd like it to be. So, yeah, there are some long hours that we put in, but it all ends up getting, you know, it all ends up working out. I guess I'll say, because then I get to go and take my vacation to Portugal and go home for Christmas. And you actually get paid a 13th month when you work in Belgium too. So the taxes are really high. Taxes are essentially 50% of your income here.
Oh my God.
Yeah. But the thing is, rent is low. So remember, I was living in San Francisco. So anything's lower than that. But the cost of living is interesting here, because sometimes I pay a lot more than I would have expected to pay. Like, going out to eat is much more expensive than I would think it should be. But then on the other hand, rent is very, very, very affordable. So, and for decent places. So I live in a nice place that where the rent is decent. And sure, they may take 50% in taxes, but I also have everything covered. So like if I go to the doctor, here's the thing. Number one, I pay a tiny amount of money to go see the doctor. I can essentially walk in when I need to see him if it's during walk-in hours. Doctors will actually make house calls here. And you can afford everything. So for example, you're in the hospital for a couple days. That's just a couple hundred euros at the most. And you're going to get reimbursed for most of that through your mutuality, which is a sort of kind of health insurance. Mm-hmm. Which is essentially you sign up for your health insurance and there are a couple different ones that you can choose. And then that essentially covers the little bit that you're already paying. You just get reimbursed for most of what you pay into healthcare anyway. So the little bit that I do pay to go into my healthcare, most of it then comes back to me anyway. So it's not quite free, but it gets really, really close.
Sounds close. Yeah, this sounds very novel compared to what we're dealing with right now here.
Yes, indeed. And I think you'd find most people flabbergasted by the very idea. Like, I feel very well taken care of here. Mm-hmm. And I realize that people sometimes hate this idea of, like, high taxes and so on and so forth. But as long as you're making a livable wage, I never really think about it. You know what I mean? Like, it's you don't really think about taxes as long as you're living comfortably. And honestly, you know, I go around this country and everything's beautiful and kept up and I get really good healthcare. And it seems all sort of worth it to me.
Yeah.
But, you know, maybe I'm some kind of crazy socialist or something. I don't know. But
it sounds pretty great.
Yeah, it's really good. Like, it's
yeah,
really
you're living
good.
In a cool place. If you have any medical issues, they're kind of taken care of. And you're doing just fine, eating good food and going on vacation soon.
Yeah, and so everything's really efficient, too. Like, it's not like, you know, I hear people say, oh, well, healthcare is socialized, but you probably have to wait forever. And it's probably not very good. It's like, no. No. When I need to go see the doctor, I can just go. And then you make an appointment for something, like I've had appointments for various reasons. I've had to go see doctors and go to the hospital and tests and so forth this year. And so I've gone and, you know, make an appointment and you're just in for the tests. Like I had to have an endoscopy done and then they do an endoscopy in 3 days and I just go in and it's quick and they give you the results and then they give you your prescriptions and the medicines and you go and get them at the pharmacy and you're done. And all of it's like incredibly inexpensive. So yeah, and friendly. And so, you know, and the hospitals are, you know, at least the hospital I go to, which is, St. Lucas is, state of the art. With great care. And I really like my home doctor, who's a very old school homey doctor in a sense, like with a tiny little office and, you know, he doesn't have a nurse, you know, and like I broke my wrist soon after I moved here. And, that was another story, but like you bike around a lot. You end up biking around a lot in this city. And, but they have the light rails called Deline, which is basically just light rails and they have grooves in the streets everywhere you go, which are of course just slightly wider than bicycle tires. So it's very common for people, that lose control of where they're going or aren't paying attention to ride into the groove, at which point their tire catches and they go tumbling.
Oh yeah.
So that happened to me and I broke my wrist in the process and I go to the doctor and of course I end up breaking my wrist and getting x-rays and stuff like that. In the end, we didn't really do anything. It just healed on its own, even though it was really painful for months. But I went, and all of it was like 30 euros, which is like $35.
Oh,
but you go, and you know, he's got his old, really old x-ray machine in another room. and he's doing it all himself. And everybody's just like one at a time. You go. And he just calls you in and then everything that needs to be done is done. And then you go and then the next person is called in and sort of an honor system when you get in. You don't even really check in. You just go and sit down in the waiting room.
This sounds old school in a really cool way.
But most of it's much more, much more organized because Belgians love their red tape. So you go and usually, like, if I go, to the hospital to get tests or whatever, you go and you take a number and then you go to the person in the front and she gives you all your stickers with your name and medical ID number and appointment information. And you have to take that before you go to your appointment in the building. So I don't know. It's like I said, it's all different. And for me, it was so new and a lot to get used to, but now it sort of feels like, well, this is the way it is. You know what I mean? Like now it feels like this is the way it is. Although for a long time, it was essentially relearning everything I thought I knew about living life.
It's insane. Yeah. Like it's not just moving a state. It's moving an entire like different culture, different way people do stuff. Like you said, like the idea of just knowing that when you go home, you have to buy all this like just over the counter stuff because it may make life easier than waiting in line or waiting behind all, like you said, red tape. Like that's stuff you couldn't ever really prepare for. Maybe if you super like Google search things.
Yeah, but... and it's not like it's a huge culture shock. It's still Belgium. You know what I mean? Like it's still Europe. It's not like I moved to Russia, or it's not like I moved to East Asia or something like that, where it would be so much, much harder. At least here, it's got that semblance of familiarity.
How has the actual work transition been for you? Because you've been there for about a year. Like you said, you're about to get into Crunch for Divinity 2, which has been out in early access, but you're approaching that official release date. I mean, people knew you for your writing at GameSpot, but you were tinkering with game development while you were at Tron Worlds and like right after GameSpot. I think even some like personal projects at the end of your GameSpot run. Is it mostly writing item descriptions, dialogue, lore, stuff like that? Or do you get a chance to at all get your hands dirty on any sort of design stuff? Like, what's your kind of role there been this year?
Yes. all of that. And well, so here's the thing. Like, I mean, my position is as a writer on Divinity Original Sin 2. But the thing is, when you're a writer on the game, you also end up sort of being a quest designer as well. Or a situation designer, an event designer, and that kind of thing, because you're part of the team, the narrative team that sort of decides what's going to happen and sort of creating the outline of everything. You're part of that process before a word even gets written that goes into the game. You're part of the process where you help decide what the story is going to be. You help decide who the stars of that story are going to be. What the themes are going to be, you know, the arcs that you're going to undertake and the choices that you'll end up making and so on and so forth. So, you know, you sort of have all the documents that you prepare, which are very much living documents all the time. You know, something can start as simply a Word document or a Google Doc, which ends up turning into, you know, quest design documents and flowcharts that go with them. And, they sort of get written and scripted in tandem. There's always a little bit of a back and forth between. So once you have a situation and you're going into it, it sort of becomes a collaboration between a writer and a scripter. So a scripter is basically the person who makes the event work and gets the sequence of events in there and so on and so forth. So anything that you're doing in the game that's an actual quest, a situation, anything that's not systemic, is the work of a scripter, and the writer, of course, that collaborates with them. And so it sort of becomes a back and forth. Then you have your situation. And then, because once you start writing something, you realize that things can change or you come up with ideas that are really cool and so on and so forth. So especially in our game, which we don't really want our dialogues to be lore dumps. You know, you always want to have an interesting character and not get lost in lore when you do that. And you want people to feel in control and you want situations to feel different than they felt before. And you want them to feel different from other games and so on and so forth. And so that's always a trick. And that's always the collaboration. You know, something that starts as sounding like a very simple situation can end up becoming very complex, especially when you have a game like ours where player choices involve not in just within the choices you make in terms of what you do. Like I can just go, you know, in our game, you can go up and attack anybody.
Yeah.
For example. And you can kill everybody and still win our game. It's always been like a philosophy for Larian is like, you can, if you kill everybody in the game world that's killable, you can still win.
That has to be so hard to design for.
It's very hard to design for, but there's also, you know, this time around we have, you know, you can play different races, and different, you know, we've got, you know, a generic character that you can make from scratch, or we've got origins, you know, think sort of like with Dragon Age Origins where you can, you know, you have all the different characters. Well, you know, these are all, you know, playable people. You know, these are all really cool playable people with their own backstories that have their own quest lines through the game and so on and so forth. So, you know, we have to take into account all of this. And it ends up getting really, really complicated, but that's one of the fun parts is when you're going through this and you're starting to write the dialogue for a character, for example, and you start getting branches. And, you know, think a BioWare game, for example, when you're playing a game and you get dialogue branches that sort of help you roleplay who you are and help decide what the future of the game is going to hold for you. And it's really fun to create stuff like that. Especially because when you're in the story, you know, you're writing the dialogue and you realize, well, wouldn't it be cool? It feels very natural that I should then be able to ask this and that this will be the result of that. And so you start adding this stuff in and, things can get a little complex to the point where scriptures are like, okay, you gotta calm yourself down. And eventually you have to erect a wall here or everything's just going to be a spider of, you know, just so many branches that you just have an incredible mess of options. And you start realizing that some of the most complicated things that you end up doing are things that, maybe 5%, 10% of the people that play the game will actually even know of or enjoy. But that's part of the fun of it because that's how you make somebody feel really special when they play, is that when they come across that thing that you know that not a lot of people will experience, it just makes that thing that you just did feel all that much cooler.
What's been the most surprising part about working on a game of this size? And like you said, with this many kind of webbing with when you're doing dialogue and you're going down all these different paths, it can probably get super, like your head starts spinning of like, oh, this is connected to that. Like since you started working there, what's kind of been the one thing you just did not expect?
I think one thing I didn't expect, you know things going into it, right? I mean, I was in, you know, games writing for so long that it's not as though I didn't know things, but knowing them intellectually and then experiencing them for yourself can be very different. And I think one thing that maybe I wasn't as prepared for as I thought I was is just how much is done so relatively late in the development process. I don't think I really realized how much of the development, how it was all sort of divvied up and how much of the execution comes down to a matter of months when you always sort of imagine that it was done in a matter of years.
Yeah. That sounds terrifying.
It's terrifying.
I guess like half the game doesn't even look like it's there by like a couple months before you have to release.
Yeah, it can be terrifying. And that's not to say that it's unusual or that it wasn't planned well, because that's not really the case. But you end up realizing just how much is sort of put together. Like a lot of game development is making the pieces of things, but not having them in their homes, as it were. You know, you have little pieces of stuff. You know, you over here you've got art doing their thing, and then over here you've got programming doing its thing, and you know, a lot of times you sort of rely on all those other pieces to be able to start putting your pieces together. And, you know, even at this point, you see all these individual pieces all sitting around like a bunch of Lego things sitting around on the floor that are put like, here's a castle over here and here's this thing over here. And then you start putting them together and it's sort of incredible just how much that contributes to the ambience of something.
Yeah.
Or when finally, you know, we're finally getting, you know, final music going in to certain areas where it was just, you know, not music for that area before. It was just placeholder music. And so suddenly this thing starts changing before your eyes. And it's sort of incredible when that starts happening, because then you really, you know, you're already thinking, wow, we're making this amazing thing, which is something I think of, I think every day. Wow, we're making this amazing thing. And then something happens and suddenly you're like, oh, it's even more amazing now. How is that even possible? And it's because all these Lego parts are being pushed into the big Lego thing that is the game. And people are coming over and hey, my castle's ready. Let's stick it on. And then it's stuck on and it's like, whoa, this is really cool. And also I have 12 million of my own castles to make between now and September.
So, man, September's coming up.
It's really coming fast. But it's really, really cool, especially, and because that's partially true on the creative side too. Like, I'll give you an example. I think this is all cool to talk about because Gareth is in early access. So one of the characters I write is named Gareth, and an upright warrior kind of guy, a paladin type. You know, he's not a paladin by title, but he's a paladin type. And if you're a writer, you sort of know that sometimes the goody two shoes can be the hardest kind to write. But then as you start writing and as we start developing the story further and the game further and the characters within it further, you actually discover how cool you can make them. And it's sort of like digging into this character's psyche and you start revealing things that are really cool. And now it's super exciting to write Gareth. Now, when I first started writing Gareth, I was like, I'm not really into this dude. And then now that I'm, you know, written so much of Gareth, I'm like, I like Gareth a lot. I like writing Gareth a lot because now you get to see his, you know, you're crafting an arc and now you don't just see him being a goody two shoes. You get to see where it goes from there and shape that. There's some really cool stuff there. Plus I've got incredible colleagues that are all making fantastic characters. And I'm really excited to see what people think, especially because I never really thought of Original Sin 1 as a game about characters or about story. It was a game about systems. Mm-hmm. The great thing about Original Sin 2 is it's still a game about systems, but it's also a game about story and about the decisions you make, not just in what you do when you explore, but in also how you react to people when you talk. And that's super exciting.
How attached do you get to these characters that you write? Because you did mention that a lot of the voice acting is later. Like when you finally actually hear a character that you've kind of written from scratch to a certain extent, finally speaking in these situations, in these different quests, is it kind of surreal?
It's surreal and it's awesome. And you must never, ever, ever let yourself become attached. Ever, ever, ever. I knew this going into it, but when I first ran into it, I mean, there are a couple things that have happened to me since I've been there. So for example, when I first started my first month at Larian, you know, when you're still working through, you know, even then a year ago, we were still working through the right tone and putting the right characters in the world. And a lot of stuff changes, you know, just from day to day and week to week and month to month, you know, incredible story and plot points exist now that didn't exist, say, 2 months ago. And so it can be really fascinating, but in that process, you learn to let go. When I first started, one of my first characters I wrote with this was this crocodile that was sort of like, that ended up being sort of Hannibal Lecter-ish. And he was best friends with a kid named Han. So Han is still in the game, but the crocodile is not. And it's not because the crocodile was bad or whatever. It's just that it didn't end up working out. And so that happens a lot where something that you do just ends up not working out and it's thrown out and you got to get over it. And at first I wasn't getting over it. And every so often, even now, I don't quite get over it. But, you end up realizing that, and especially because Sven is, you know, again, our CEO is really good at knowing when something's not working and when you just have to let it go.
Yeah.
So I get involved with these characters. I bring them to life. I make sure that they're interesting and awesome and that you enjoy spending time with them, whether they're good or evil or somewhere in between. And if I have to say goodbye, I say goodbye and just clean that brain area of them forever. Because that's what you gotta do. you just gotta. But it's cool when, you know, something's there and good and forever in the game, unless something really awful happens and suddenly I come in one day and Sven's like, well, we've decided to get rid of Gareth and we're going to replace him with somebody else. It's like, no, but, you know, that kind of thing is really cool, to sort of hear them speaking.
Yeah.
Even when it's not my own character, when it's somebody else's. So I get really involved with some of our origin characters, which are the playable characters that basically have their own stories and their own pasts. And one of them is a lizard called the Red Prince. Mm-hmm. And as you can imagine, he's a red lizard and he comes from royalty. And when you first, you know, I heard him speak for the first time in the game, I was like, that's not what I thought the Red Prince would sound like. It sounds better than what I thought Red Prince would sound like.
Oh, that's awesome.
And I'm kind of impressed with the way it's going, because a lot of the voicing and stuff is done by a company called Pit Stop, which sort of is our liaison when it comes to creating and getting voice actors and making the recordings and that sort of thing. And they're just phenomenal. I don't know how they do it. And then we started going through the other day, just as an aside, in one of our Slack channels, we started putting up pictures of the voice actors who were doing the biggest parts. And it was sort of weird how the voice actors seemed to even physically embody the characters that we'd written in a really creepy way. So to give you an example, and I forget the name of the actress. I wish I could remember right off the top of my head so I could say, hey, go Google her and immediately when you see her, you sort of understand the character that she plays. So there's this character named Losa who sort of struggles with a demon in her head. And she's kind of freaky and funny and sort of dark and light at the same time. It's really hard to explain Losa. She's just really complicated and really cool. And we saw the images of this actress playing her, and it's like, yeah, that's exactly who should be playing Losa. It's just really neat to see all that come together. It's really incredible.
Has the fact that the game has been out on early access made it, you mentioned like you struggled to lose that character you wrote early, because even if you're trying not to get attached, you are to a certain extent attached to certain characters, certain writing. Is it weird seeing all this feedback on something that isn't done? Like, is it hard not sometimes take that stuff personally, just from Twitter comments or the community overall, or has it been positive enough that you haven't really run into any situations?
I don't read anything.
That's smart.
So here's the thing.
Avoid the comments kind of strategy.
This is always a really tricky thing, which is, of course, we want people's feedback. We want to know what people think, and we want to adjust to that. But I need to let other people be doing that. Do you know what I mean? Like, there are people higher in the ladder whose job is to be doing that, because I know if I go in, and most of it's positive, thank goodness. But I know if I go in and it got myself lost in that I might end up being in the same place that I often went to when I was writing about games and working at GameSpot, which is sometimes you can go down very dark roads. So I let the people whose job it is to look out for feedback deal with that and filter it through wherever it needs to filter before it would come to me. And trust me, if Sven doesn't like something, or he's passing on something that's not good, he's not going to mince words about it. So eventually, if something's off, it will make it to me, and it will make it to me in no uncertain terms. So it's probably best I hear that from Sven rather, or from someone else, rather than just getting it straight from the source, unfiltered. Yeah. You know, let it be pasteurized and homogenized before it comes to my desk, I guess, is sort of my approach to it.
Yeah, it's probably the smart way to live. I know with Here They Lie, which is like the first game with my name in the credits, so much of what I did was about, you know, talking to different media people to see if they wanted to review it. They're doing social media. So much of my job was immediately seeing reactions to stuff.
Yeah.
And even though I wasn't like, I didn't make that game. I didn't like create all these scenarios that all these people who I work with, you know, spent years building up, but just seeing any sort of criticism, this it's the immediate kind of gut punch you get when you, back in the day for GameSpot, when I would see certain comments and certain reviews, like it's the exact same type of thing that it's hard to avoid. And a lot of my job is looking directly at that. I'll always remember waking up during the day the embargo lifted, and I see the first review is Game Informer, and it's like an 8.5 out of 10, and I'm like, oh my god, this is amazing. Next review is Jim Sterling. It was a 1 out of 10.
Oh my god. And,
yeah, it was like one of those.
I know the
it
feels.
Was my first experience. Yeah, on the other side of an embargo lifting, and you're like, what is going on? And it's so strange. Now that you have been this involved with the project, like, would you? I don't know if I would. Would you review games any differently if you did it right now? Like, has seeing kind of the machinations, the guts, the how the sausage is made, changed how you would maybe critique a game, or has that not really changed at all?
No. It hasn't changed at all. Gotcha. Unless you live in a hole, you already sort of understand if you're writing about games. At least certainly if you're writing about them at a major publication, you already understand that games are made by passionate people who work very hard, right? So there's no question that bad games are made by good, talented people. It's just sort of the way it is. The other thing I think a lot of people don't realize is that most of the time, and I wouldn't say all of the time, but most of the time when a game comes out, the people who make the game already know what's wrong with it.
Yes.
And so therefore, a lot of the time you have a fairly good idea of how people are going to feel and how a game is going to review. And you sort of understand, you know, even I as a player, you know, it's been helpful, I guess, having me on the team, because I can still play a game from that old perspective, from that old critical perspective. Totally. And then I can take that to Sven or to somebody and say, well, this is what I'm thinking as I'm playing this. And if I were a critic, this is what I would say. But that's the thing. I mean, usually when I say something like that, I'm not saying something somebody doesn't already know. So it's always just a matter of, I mean, in the end, you have to make a game, you have to release something. And, you know, we can't take a decade, fiddling around with it to make it absolutely, absolutely the most perfect thing you've ever played. And I don't think I would want it to be that anyway. I eventually want the art out there with, you know, whatever flaws and whatever foibles it might have, so that people can see our creation. And, I'm really proud of it, just exactly as it is right now. So, you know, in another 2.5 months, my God, what is it going to be? Is it going to be even more amazing than this? How is that possible? And so I don't know, like, but that's the thing. Like, nothing about how I view games has changed. If anything, I'm more attuned to things that are a problem from the very moment of design, as opposed to something that's just a matter of execution. Like, I'm probably more sensitive to things that, you know, were straight up decisions that made something bad.
Yeah.
Than I am to a mistake made in the execution that turned something good into something that was less than good. And so I'm actually less patient with that kind of thing, less patient with design things where you know that somebody or a group of people have made very specific decisions to make something a certain way that are bad. I'm actually much less patient with that than I probably would have been before. But overall, no, I wouldn't change anything, because in the end, when a player's playing, they don't care. And I don't know that it necessarily needs to matter to them. You know, what matters is that whatever you make is within the bounds of what you understand of how to make.
Yeah.
You should still push those boundaries. You shouldn't just say, oh, well, you know, I can only make so and so, so I'm going to stick within these rigid boundaries. No, you should push the boundaries, but you go outside of them too far and you can lose the plot. Yeah. And so I'm good with right. And that's another thing Sven's really good at. He knows exactly what he has with his team, and he knows exactly what they can make, and then has us make something that's 120% of that instead of just 100% that. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what I want to be doing. Like, I want to make something that I know can be extremely good, but I also want to find out what that extra 20% of that extra 20% is that I know that I didn't know I could make that was good.
Yeah, I think it's cool to have those perspectives out there from people who have worked on major games, who you mentioned kind of understanding, all right, this was just kind of a flawed design decision instead of a good idea that was executed poorly. I had Mike Laidlaw from the Dragon Age team on recently, and we had talked kind of about how he looks at reviews and how he uses them, and he streams a lot on Twitch, and what he does is he'll play other people's games to kind of be like, all right, I think this is why this happened. I think this is why they made this decision, or this part in Firewatch, there's this certain kind of bend in this area so that everything in front of you can load while you're going through a kind of basic area. And I think it's just fascinating to hear that perspective. And like you, now that I've been in development for a bit, I don't think it would change at all how I review games, but it's definitely given me a different perspective maybe into how games are actually put together, even if in the end, you know, the final product is the final product. If you're paying $60 for it or whatever amount of money, it shouldn't really matter. But struggles in development or anything like that, the actual game should be what you're critiquing. Do you miss reviewing games at all? Like, are there any games that came out recently where you're like, God damn it, I wish I could write about this on GameSpot or some other site?
Yeah, I do, actually. I miss it from time to time. I miss it all the time in some ways. One of the things I miss is that when you review games for a living, you're constantly playing new games. Yeah. And I don't have that luxury anymore, as it were. So I end up, you know, playing a lot fewer games. And so that's just sort of one of the downsides of suddenly I'm not playing games for a living anymore, so I play fewer games. Woe is me, right? But there are times where I have strong opinions about something and I wish that I had, I mean, I could go to a blog post and post them, but you know, again, that's taking up a lot of time in the end for something that I can say in three tweets, mm-hmm. for example. So I miss those times when I could really break something down. And, you know, there was a time after I left GameSpot where I was still blogging here and there about stuff like that, but I don't keep up really well with stuff like that. You know, you end up getting a full-time job and, you know, moving across the world. And so stuff like that sort of takes a backseat. There are times where there is something that comes out. Like, when Final Fantasy 15 came out, for example, like, wow, I wish I had the forum to write about this. Or when, you know, even early on, soon after I left GameSpot, when things like Fallout 4 came out or, you know, when No Man's Sky came out this year and stuff like that, there have definitely been those times. It was this year, right? I think it was this year.
No, it was actually, this year. It was last year. I think it was last year. I think No Man's Sky is like a year. I think I did a podcast about it and not liking it. I'm actually going to Google it right now. My guess is it came out like last summer, which is going to be August 9th, 2016.
I think you're right. Oh, my God. This is what happens with time when you're in game development. You really, really lose track of it. But anyway, yeah, there are things, you know, both things that you love and both things that you don't love that give you a lot that you have to say.
Yeah.
And certainly there are games like that. And, you know, I could have, you know, I certainly never finished Final Fantasy 15. I couldn't stomach it anymore. But I know a lot of people love that game and I think it's an interesting game to talk about and it's an interesting game to, you know, to sort of put in your head and sort of turn in there and sort of look at different sides and angles. And boy, I would have had a lot of fun writing a Final Fantasy 15 review.
Yeah.
Something I wouldn't have done if I hadn't, you know, if I hadn't finished it. But even now as a non-finishing player of Final Fantasy 15, I certainly have a lot of negative things to say about it.
Yeah, I'm 12 hours in and I stopped there. And I think I'm in a similar boat as you with a lot of not great things to say about that game.
But then there's the other side of that, which is, okay, so for example, I'm not a Zelda guy, right? Mm-hmm. I don't have Nintendo nostalgia for one. And I think that's always been a part of why I'm not as drawn to a lot of Nintendo things, which for me as a non-Nintendo nostalgia person, if there is such a thing, I don't get as much out of those games because I'm just constantly noticing how they don't live up to games that are like them.
Yeah.
But then something, you know, so for example, I liked Twilight Princess, but I certainly didn't love it. And I thought Skyward Sword was what I played. I didn't get more than, you know, a certain number of hours in where I was like, how do people put themselves through this? That's exactly what I thought with Skyward Sword. It's, even in the first hour, I was like, I get that this is a game that's supposed to be friendly to new players, but that doesn't mean that I want Nintendo to treat me like I'm the stupidest person who's ever walked the planet. And so I'm never really taken by Zelda. On the other hand, when the 3DS, Link Between Worlds?
Yep, that's right.
When that came out, I thought, wow, this is really great. And it was in my top 10 for the year. So on a whim this year, I went out on the day the Switch released. So I had sold my Wii U before I came because I needed all the money I could get for the move. So my intent was to go to Game Mania, which is the local game store.
Oh, that's a great name.
Yeah. And I went and I was like, okay, I want to play Zelda. So maybe they'll have a Switch, but there's no way in hell they'll have a Switch. So what I'll do is I'll just buy a used Wii U and get a copy of the Wii U Zelda, right? Mm. So lo and behold, they actually had one Switch available.
Wow.
So I bought the Switch and I bought Zelda and I came home. And one of the first things that happened is that I had that big problem a lot of other people have had with the left Joy-Con.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Not syncing properly.
Yep.
So that was kind of a pain. But then I finally started playing Zelda for real, and I was just like, wow, this is really effing good. It's not reinventing the wheel when it comes to this kind of game, but I felt involved from the very beginning, which is something that I did not feel when I played Horizon Zero Dawn, and I know a lot of people love that game.
Oh, yeah, I love it.
And I need to get back to it, because the first 2 hours didn't get me involved. The first 2 hours are essentially Aelon talking about things that are happening as they happen, and I wanted to put my foot through the screen, because my first thought as a games writer is, this is really bad. I can see what's happening. You don't have to describe them for me in every detail.
It gets less like that moving forward.
It's a little
hand-holdy, but it adjusts.
Totally. And I know that when I get back to that I'll probably have a really good time. But, you know, it's one of those things where a first impression may not be bad, but you might have five other things on your plate that you could be playing, and you sort of mosey onto those things and get involved. And I just left it behind. I mean to go back to Breath of the Wild. I still need to get back to that, too, because I played, I don't know, a couple dozen hours before, like, Overwatch takes over my life, and then we're crunching and so on and so forth. But it's amazing. And it's the sort of thing where, as a non-Zelda fanatic, I'm like, boy, I wish I could write a review of this from the non-Zelda fanatic point of view and talk about what's really right about this. Mm. Because it's really good. There are also things that I think are silly that people tend to overlook. But, you know, maybe that I think that's part of the charm of big Nintendo fans is they almost enjoy overlooking things.
They really do.
But yeah, I mean, overall, I think, you know, however many Game of the Year awards Zelda takes away this year, it'll have earned them.
Is that your favorite game so far this year? I know you're like me, where Overwatch kind of just consumes everything, where like I could be playing this or that. Like I'm playing I just played through Resident Evil 7, and god, for some reason I still have Wildlands I'm trying to finish, which is not a great
movie.
Yeah, I know, it's one of those
why
things
are you even
where, like,
bothering
now that I'm so close to the end. I want to just keep going. I get stubborn with it when I'm like, I'll just finish this. And now I'm playing Persona 5, which I really, really enjoy. But
oh,
like,
that game's super good. Yeah.
Yeah, Persona's been great. Resident Evil 7, for some reason, like, shocked me at how good it was until, like, the last 3 or so hours, which aren't really that good.
I need to get back to that one, too. I started playing that, and it was like, it's not because I wasn't enjoying it, but it fell away.
That was a shocker to me, because I usually don't love horror stuff. It actually almost scared me so much I almost quit. I was at that level of, like, I can't turn this corner.
Just the opening bit, which is sort of like the prologue. Is really, really great. So that, you know, what I played in that game left a really fantastic impression. And again, it's one of those things where it's like, oh, but I got so much to play. And I sort of get, you know, sort of bogged down almost by the choices. It's like, well, yeah. I have so many things to play, so I'm just going to go back to the thing I always play instead.
That's
it, which is weird.
I have that issue so hard. When I was reviewing games for GameSpot, like, that was, it's like, all right, this is an assignment. Like, I'm getting paid for this. I'm just going to focus on this game. But now that I don't do that, like, yeah, I get overwhelmed with choices. Then I'm just like, I'm going to play Overwatch or Battlegrounds or MLB The Show or something that's not, like, story-based. I need to focus on. I need a game to, like, take my mind off of the other games I have to play.
That's why you can go and play a few rounds of Overwatch or whatever and feel like you're getting something out of it.
Yeah.
But feel like you can sit down and it'll give you something for the little bit of time you put in. And
totally.
You know, but even my love affair with Overwatch is sort of waning with this new season. Stuff that's always sort of been there and bothered me that's more or less community related, have really dropped this season down pretty quickly for me. And I'm just getting tired of it. You know,
Solo queuing on PC competitive?
Yes, PC competitive is usually where I play.
Yeah, that sounds like a cesspool.
With just, you know, with some time in arcade just to freshen things up and whatnot and have a little bit of fun. But, you know, part of my fun with Overwatch is being able to take competition seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying that I'm a great Overwatch player. I'm fairly mediocre. And yet I have a pretty good handle on how to win and how to use each hero more or less and in what circumstances and what counters what and so on and so forth and how to, you know, how to play the maps, team comp, all that stuff. So, I mean, those are basics to me, right?
Yeah.
So you don't have to be great to at least get a handle on those things and have a good basis for winning. And that's where Overwatch competitive fails so much of the time is not because people are good or bad, but because people just don't have a handle on those basics, or most of the time it's not that they don't even have a handle on them, it's just that they completely don't care.
Yeah.
And that not caring is what's really turned competitive play into a cesspool at this point. Because it really has become, you know, every other game has somebody leaving, or disconnecting. Every other game has somebody, you know, two snipers who won't switch and ruin the game. And every other game has, you know, nobody will take a healer, or there are 5 DPS. And then at the end of the round, all those DPS complain about the team comp. And this is just, it's a struggle every time, where one game after another, and somebody on Twitter said, well, just play with a team. Yeah, well, that's all fine if I have a team to play with.
Yeah.
And, you know, I have a regular group of people that I can do this with. But honestly, my times in Overwatch are random, you know, and especially because most of my friends are still, you know, in the States or elsewhere, I can't really do that. I don't have a bunch of Euro friends.
Yeah, you're probably done with work.
Exactly.
Like, yeah.
And I'm on the Euro servers, you know, for very obvious reasons and very good reasons. And so I end up playing with randos most of the time. You know, I've met people through the game that, you know, will invite each other and win pretty well then when you're playing with somebody you've played with before, who sort of takes it seriously. But that's the other thing, like, people say, why are you taking it so seriously? Well, it's competitive play, you know. I'm not saying that's the fun of it. Yeah, exactly. Like, you sort of come to win. That's sort of the fun that you get out of it. If this, you know, I'm not saying that I go in there and I'm like some kind of like raging jerk, although I can't say that hasn't happened one or two times before. But, you know, that's part of my fun. If I wanted to just have whatever type fun, I would go and play quick play.
Yeah.
But I go with the idea that not only do I like this game because of what it is, but I also go because I like to win, and I have more fun when I win than when I lose. So that's why it's just bizarre that there's so many trolls, you know, Maze that wall you into your own base. And
oh, fuck that.
It's been a while since I've had a Symmetra put a teleporter on an edge. So that hasn't happened to me in a while. But I certainly have had enough Symmetras lately just putting the damn teleporter in the middle of the point, or right in view of the enemy team, or whatever. Do you know what I mean?
Like, yeah, no, so, I mean, it's funny because it's it almost seems like we are playing two different games, where I've had a lot of those issues, but I do think you're right. It's hard just to say like, oh, get a team. Like that's not an easy thing to do. I'm PS4 and I play with three other people at all times. So we always have a group of four, and I've had like, I don't think anyone's left a competitive game that I've played in maybe like 3 months. It's just, it's strange because people really do stick together in groups, but I'm the same way as you, where I play Overwatch because of how competitive I get with it, how much I do enjoy winning. It's actually made quick play feel kind of useless. Like, the quick play is cool to test out heroes, but like, other than that, I have no interest. What's really killed my Overwatch like hunger is the Roadhog nerf, which sounds silly to say one character has made me want to stop playing this game that I think I've now put 350 hours in. But of my 350 hours, I think 270 have been Roadhog. And I got to this point where I was like, last season, Master Rank. So I was like at 3,700, 3,750 or something like that, competitive points. And now they've completely like reduced Roadhog's character to just being like this toothless fat dude who can't kill anyone anymore. And it's made me entirely want to stop. But this, the PC thing you're talking about is like, I can only imagine how frustrating it is when you're playing with a lot of other solo queuers who, as soon as they get angry about something, they're like, fuck it, I'm leaving. When you have like a team of three or something, it's harder to just
all
leave.
Yeah, you're playing capture and hold, and you'll lose the first round, and they're always the dude who's like, oh, fuck it. And then they just take Torbjorn.
Oh,
and then it's just like, dude, really? It's just one round, and it's the first one.
Yeah, it's always a crapshoot. You never know. Like, yeah, I've come down from like 0-2 so many times, like, you're totally fine if you just lose the first round.
Yeah. And so it's always so bizarre just the way that happens. And I guess that's just online gaming for you. But it's because it's my online game of choice and because it's personally affecting me, then that's the soapbox that I am currently on. But I mean, to give you an idea of other games, like, I'm just looking up my Steam list right now. And this says nothing about like the stuff that's installed on my PS4. And, you know, the stuff that I've bought that I need to get to. So what I've got installed through Steam right now is Dead Cells, Elder Scrolls Online expansion, Night in the Woods, The Signal from Tolva, Torment, Vanquish, of course.
Of course.
Age of Wonders 3 and Baldur's Gate 2 are sort of the things on there. And of course, I've played Baldur's Gate 2 before, but I, you know, sometimes I just get that hankering where you want to go back and play one of those games again. Age of Wonders 3, because I've been in the mood for something a little bit more strategic. But then I have a hard time getting into that because that requires hours of attention. And I'm like, I only have 15 minutes. but then over on the PS4, like just sitting there staring at me whenever I boot it up are things like Persona 5 and Horizon Zero Dawn. And oh God, what else is on there? Injustice 2. Skyrim. Skyrim re-release, which I started playing. Nothing like replaying a Bethesda game to really remind you of all the things that you don't like about a Bethesda game, but also to remind you of all the things that you do. And stuff like that. Like, so I've just got all this stuff. Oh, the Darksiders 2 re-release, which isn't actually, the port's not all that good on PS4. I don't know, how it is elsewhere.
That's a bummer because I really like Darksiders.
Oh, Darksiders 2 is amazing. And one of those great games people tend to forget about that every so often I'll just remind them that it's awesome. So it's just stuff like that. You know, like I've got all this stuff and yeah, I miss it. I miss being able to get through as many games as I used to get through. But I never will stop. I mean, I've always felt that if you're making games, you always need to make sure you are playing games, which can be hard to do, but I think it's really, really important. And that's another thing that makes me glad I'm on the Larian team, because somebody will come up with an idea or we'll start putting together an idea and I'll be like, no, we can't name it that thing because that's too much like Dragon Age. Or do you realize that this exact plot point was done at so-and-so place? You know, so that's why you need people to play games, so that you really know. Because one of the biggest things that we try to do is subvert every expectation you have about an RPG when you play. And you can't subvert something if you don't know what the expectation is to begin with. Mm. And so I'm I'm trying to apply everything that I know and love about RPGs, and trying to do that in Divinity Original Sin to, so that when people think that they've got a handle on it, that they understand it because it's like this other RPG, I always want to make sure that it goes the opposite direction. You know what I mean? Like, I always want to make sure that we're subverting, averting, taking it to places that you don't expect. It's really, really important to me.
I think that's critical. Yeah. Like, I, with, like, working on a horror game, like the actual going against player expectations is so massive. Like, you can't do exactly what they want, and having a team of people who, like Corey Davis, who worked on Spec Ops The Line, but, you know, not exactly a horror game, but has those horror game trappings. Yeah. Like, you need to do the opposite of what people want so many times. And I think you're totally right with RPGs. You can't do the same type of storylines, do the same type of setup that games like Dragon Age and all these other things have done. You did mention Dead Cells. You should totally play more Dead Cells. Dead Cells,
yeah, like, yeah.
Maybe my biggest random surprise game I didn't know about until, like, I think Justin McElroy from Polygon reviewed it. And I was like, I have no idea what this is, and played it and talked to the guys at the studio. And that game's one of the best controlling feeling games in that sort of realm, in that rogue legacy kind of
absolutely
zone. That the roles, the fact that you don't take damage when you just bump up against someone, really, I don't know, like, there's something about it where, like, it feels, I hate using Dark Souls comparisons, but it feels kind of weighty, somewhat like a Dark Souls, just very fair. Like, every time I die or get hurt, I feel like it's my fault, and it just, I don't know, I'm in love with it.
No, it's absolutely fantastic, and I mean, there are times because of my limited time where it's like, okay, I died, and now I'm back here again, and you get that moment, you're like, okay, then that now this is for tomorrow night. Yep. You know what I mean? But I keep coming back to it, and the reason I keep coming back to it, like, I typically play some every day, is because you get that moment where you unlock a new area, and you're like, oh, holy shit, this is really cool. Yeah. I can't wait to see what's out here. And so I'm making very, very slow progress. So, for example, I just unlocked, I don't know, the cool place with the castle views.
Okay, yeah.
So which is only like basically the fourth area that I've been to. But that's how slow I'm going. But it always feels so good. And I always like that. I like that slow sense of progress where, okay, you die, you end up at the beginning, but you've also made some kind of progress because you've spent cells on something, you have unlocked, you know, now you have a better weapon when you start the game off to make it easier to get through, and you get the blueprints. You're always contributing, even when you're getting, you know, thrown back to the beginning again. And also because when you unlock new abilities, you know, it's like, oh, now I can send vines up and climb them, and suddenly that changes everything. And that's of course, that's very Zelda-ish, very Dark Souls-y, you know, Castlevania, whatever, Metroidvania type of thing. So, but I don't know, I like the way it feels, and I like the way it looks, and it keeps me coming back. It's just really, really pretty.
In a unique way, like, it doesn't look like very much else that's out there. And, like, yeah, like you said, even though you are being thrown back to the start, even just every time I go deeper and deeper, I feel like I'm just getting better understanding how that game controls, how the enemy patterns work, when to roll, how to slash, like, stuff like that. Even the non-tangible cells or anything like that, I just feel like I'm improving every single time I go into that game. Like, I just, it's addictive. I got really into Rogue Legacy when it came out, but I like this even more.
Yeah, and then there are those times where I pick up some of my favorite weapons, or some of my favorite grenades, like pick up an ice grenade, and it always always feels like you can conquer the world now. And especially if I've got if I've got some throwing daggers on me, and I've got the the big old sword, the broadsword, and I'm like, okay, I'm ready to kick ass now, because between that and the bear trap, like, I'm good to go.
Three health upgrades. Yeah, like three health upgrades in a row, and you're like, oh my god, I'm invincible.
Look at it, I've got like 250 health points all over. Like, what's going on here? It's just really interesting. Every run always feels a little bit unique. It always feels like you're, you know, because what you find, what you pick up is always a little bit different. You know, the challenge is a little bit different every time. but you've always got the tools because you've been there before. You know how the enemies are going to behave. Ever so often, I can get kind of annoyed where I'm like, really? Did you, these enemies together in this way? You know, like, how am I going to even do this? So every so often it feels like the procedural bits come together to feel, I don't want to say unfair, but to feel a little less, I'll just say fair.
I mean, you can get some tough
unfair, but
like,
a little
really
less
many upgrades.
Fair. Yeah.
Yeah, and there's like this just pool of enemies that are teleporting all around me while there's the shield guy that I can't deal with right now. I've definitely had those moments. That game started out as a tower defense game, which is one of the weirder stories I learned while I was talking to that studio, where like that the initial idea of that was nothing like what it actually became. And like that's another early access game that still early on, but so far, like, you could convince me that's close to a final product just by how it feels again.
Oh yeah, and in terms of just what they have, it's, I mean, they can take, they've got all the tools there. They can just continue to make the game with these tools. It's a matter of content as opposed mm-hmm. to a matter of systems. You know, they've got absolutely. What they need there. It's just a matter of adding the content to it and giving it a flow and giving it an arc.
I can't wait to see what they actually end up doing with that, like the rest of that game fills out. I have one more question for you related to games media, even though you're outside of games media now. I mean, since you left GameSpot, we've seen Glixel came up. There's been Waypoint. And I've talked about this numerous times in this podcast. It feels like when I was in high school, my goal was always like get to a Game Informer, get to a GameSpot, and I was very focused on the writing aspect of that, of being able to write smart reviews, to you know, be able to cover news, previews, whatever at the time. Now it seems like you need to understand how to podcast, to do video, maybe even edit some footage. There's like this, you need to understand how to stream, you know how to be in front of a camera. For you, do you ever wish that games media was much more like it used to be? Because right now you're really happy in your role. You're not trying to get back and over like to IGN or GameSpot or anything like that. But do you think games media is in a healthy place where everyone's kind of doing a little bit of everything? Or do you think there should be a greater focus on writing kind of how it used to be?
It depends on what day you ask me in a way. And I'm sorry, I'm starting to lose my voice. So if the pitch of my voice keeps going up and up and up, it's because I'm losing it slowly as I talk. It depends on which day you ask me, because on one hand, I love that there's niche out there that understands what it's doing and keeps doing it. Like, you've got Danny O'Dwyer doing NoClip, for example, and he knows exactly what he is and what is he wants to do and what he's doing. And he's not trying to cover all those bases, and he doesn't have to.
Yeah.
So I think that's one great way of doing it, and I love what he does. On another site, that might be one show, for example. And something that Danny really did sort of do for GameSpot for a long time, but I'm really glad he's doing what he's doing now, because then he can really stay focused on that one thing. And he's really, really good at it. And then, of course, I love Waypoint because I love those people. And for them, it's a matter of voice. It's just a matter of, they know their voice, they know their humor, they know how to bring it out, and they've established, because Austin is so great and all those other people are so great, that they just sort of, you know, hey, this is what we are and this is what we want to do, and this is, it's happening. And it's sort of the same way Giant Bomb became Giant Bomb. It's just because on the very force of who they were. And that's another way of doing it. But then you do have the big places like GameSpot and IGN and so on and so forth. And when you enter that realm, something weird happens. And that weird thing is that you end up relying on advertisers so much that you have to maintain access to all these things. And in a way, I would rather go to one of the, you know, I would rather go to a place like, say, Jimquisition or Waypoint, or, you know, see what Danny has to say about this or that, or go to one of those places, because I know that, I don't know how to say this, because I trust everyone. I don't distrust IGN or GameSpot, obviously. I worked there forever at GameSpot, but I also know how much harder it becomes there, because you're constantly chasing access. And everything is so precarious that, you know, somebody says the wrong word and suddenly, you know, like what happened with Polygon, where it's like, oh, Ubisoft has just decided not to send us stuff anymore. And at GameSpot, we had that happen. Sony's like, oh, we don't like what you said about Ratchet and Clank. We're not sending you stuff. And that happened for a while. Or, you know, somebody gets, you know, all it takes is one pissy publisher or PR person. And suddenly, you know, and you see that in lots of places. I was just reading something about crap that happened at MTV, where it's like, oh, these reviews were actually taken down because the artist said, well, I'm not going to work with you anymore then. And they're like, well, we can't have that in the higher ups. I mean, that's not really a normal thing at a place like GameSpot or IGN or anything, but I hate the fact that you have to worry about that at all, that any of those great people have to worry about that. And I've just ended up finding a lot of value in, you know, it's sort of like with movie criticisms too. It was never about where the criticism came from in terms of the publication. It was about who the critic was, you know? So I've never really been all that interested in following a website or a magazine as much as I'm interested in following the person whose takes touch me in some way, whether or not I agree with them. And those are the people that I follow from place to place. Austin is certainly one of those people. So whether he, you know, whether it be at Giant Bomb or at Waypoint or wherever it is, you know, that's, you know, I will follow him where he goes because I want to read Austin. That's what matters to me. Or I want to see what Danny has to say, or I want to know what Jim has to say, because even if I disagree with it, it's going to certainly be entertaining and also have insight. So that's what I like, is there really is a lot of variety out there. I just wish that when it came to the larger places that it wasn't so hard. They didn't have to worry so much about having access to things. They didn't have to worry about what, you know, about losing an advertiser, have to worry about not getting review code for games because they didn't like what you had to say. And I'm fortunate that at GameSpot, I was never asked to say anything different than what I had to say. And I don't think that that happens at all there. But I also know that that means management has to look at that and has to push that back. And I know that, you know, sometimes that means creating different kinds of content. I think the media itself is actually in a healthy place. I think how the industry reacts to media is not.
I mean, that's kind of like, I usually seek out the personality based places like Giant Bomb, but that also has that, they have that, what really helps them is their subscriber base that is paying for a lot of that site, where, like you said, I don't think GameSpot or IGN are, you know, adjusting what people say all the time on the reviews, because
no, they don't. But
they are more beholden to advertisers than someone who's maybe being supported by Patreon or someone who's being supported by subscribers. And it's a different. Even if it's not happening, it's different how things could be covered sometimes.
Yeah, and so I don't know. I end up doing what I always did, which is I sort of go everywhere if I'm interested in something. I go everywhere to see what people are thinking about. I was just on GameSpot yesterday to see what they said about this or that, because I like going to the site and seeing what's been reviewed recently. And I use that a lot of the time just to uncover something I might be interested in that I might not have been interested in, that I either didn't know about or didn't think I'd be interested in, but now I am. Because it's, you know, there's enough stuff that's reviewed that I get a fairly good look at what's new and interesting. Whereas I don't necessarily get that at a smaller site, you know, because they, you know, if it's one or two people, they've got much more limited time to create content. And so they have to be very picky and choosy. Whereas at GameSpot, I can go and I can see a larger list of things. But then a lot of the time I'll read the review. And then that's when I start seeking out some other stuff to read about that game, to see if it's for me. And, you know, sometimes that's also the pleasure of social media, is I'll just put a call on Twitter and say, hey, I'm thinking about this game. What are your thoughts?
Oh, totally. It's so useful in that way. It's like crowdsourcing in a way. I'm like, hey, like, what's the general sentiment on this? And again, like talking about that Polygon review with Dead Cells, like I saw that and I was like, wow, I never really heard of this. like went around to different sites for a couple other Dead Cells takes, and then I'm suddenly buying and playing Dead Cells. So yeah, there's I have different sites that's IGN and GameSpot are usually my initial, like, is this game getting good coverage? And then I'll go to maybe somewhere like Waypoint or Giant Bomb after I've played a significant portion of the game to kind of see interesting takes from people whose opinions, like you said, you value, whether it be because it's very different than what you think or very in line. You want to just read stuff like that. So yeah, I use all these different sites in random various ways. Maybe too much. I might read too much games coverage, but I enjoy doing it in that way.
Right.
Before you lose your voice,
it's getting close. Thank God.
I'll get you close. It's going to be close at this point. So last main thing I want to talk about, how Original Sin 2, again, September, it's really getting close.
Yeah.
What's kind of what's the Kevin Van Ord game plan? Like, is it, do you, you know, keep working, you write for this game until it releases, and then you guys have kind of this big DLC push and just updating the game? Like, do you plan on staying in Belgium and continuing to work with this studio long term? What's kind of your, in a perfect world, what would you like to do?
Yes, I plan on staying and working with them long term. What comes next for Larian, I'm not gonna say. Maybe partially because I don't know. But that's only partially the case. But I love this studio. I love where I'm at right now. And I don't really have any plans for that to change. And I don't think Larian has any plans on saying goodbye. So it seems like a mutual decision to have me stick around. And besides, sort of the way the law works here is that, you know, I still got a contract. I still get to stay at least up until next July. So hopefully everything will be good. Who knows, you know, if I'm here for 5 years and I can apply for a permanent residency and just stay for good.
That'd be awesome.
Although, you know, if I wanted to stay in the industry, that might end up being a hard thing just because, you know, it's not like Belgium is filled with game designer, you know, with studios all over the place. So, Larian is easily the biggest studio and most important studio in Belgium. So, but I love it here. And as long as Larian wants me to stay with them, I suspect that that's where I'll be for a while.
Well, hopefully.
I hope so.
Season 2 sells like 5 million, 10 million copies.
Well, yeah, you should totally buy it. You should absolutely totally buy it.
You'll be successful and you can just stay there and keep making all the way until like Original Sin 6.
Yeah.
It'll be great.
Buy me some job security. Get a copy of Original Sin 2. And I mean, while you're at it, buy a copy of Original Sin 1 or Original Sin 1 Enhanced Edition, or go buy a copy of Divinity 2, which is not to be confused with Divinity Original Sin 2, or grab a copy of Divine Divinity or Beyond Divinity, or anything really that says Divinity in it. Go buy a copy
buy
of Dragon Commander.
Give them your friends.
What's that?
Yeah. Just buy 10 copies, give them
to your friends.
You guys like Steam gifts. This is like a perfect strategy.
I mean, we also made Dragon Commander, so you should go out and get a copy of Dragon Commander, which is absolutely an awesome RTS sort of action game hybrid that also has role-playing elements and relationships in between battles. So I don't know how else to explain it except to say that you should go and play Dragon Commander. I'm dead serious. Like, well before I wanted to start at GameSpot, I knew Dragon Commander was coming out because I had done some coverage for it at E3, and the game looked really, really cool. And it made me sad that it was coming out and I couldn't review it. And so I had to give it to somebody else for review. And, the review just made me want it more. You know, because it was like, oh, and then the game ended up being really good. And so it was like, oh, I can't wait to play this. And then I did play some. I never finished it because you know how it goes.
Yeah.
But, that game is seriously good. So if you've never heard of Dragon Commander and you're sort of in the mood for some real-time strategy and some map-based tactics and also to love up some undead, and also to fly around on a dragon,
great.
You know, to fly around as a dragon and incinerate things while your troops below do some fighting, you know, you can do that. So
these are all the check boxes I look for when I am playing a video.
Dragon Commander is super good. And I feel like it's, you know, Divinity. I mean, Original Sin, everybody loves, and rightfully so. But I always wish that Dragon Commander got more love than it does. So go and play. Hopefully, go and play some Dragon Commander. It's really good.
This non-sponsored content part at the end will totally act as a great.
Yeah, I mean, I'm totally biased. Yeah. Because now I work with them, but that's the great. That's also the great thing about working with Larian is, you know, you always have that short list in your head of like, man, if I had my way, these are the five developers I'd most love to work with, and so you get it in your head that you've got these places where you'd love to go. Like, hey, I'd love to go to be with, you know, I'll go to Poland and be with CD Projekt Red and help make a Witcher game, or oh man, I'd love to help make Assassin's Creed, or wouldn't it be great if I could go to like. Be with Relic and make a new Dawn of War or something like that. And, you know, or Funcom, you know, and then Larian. And this was sort of like my, you know, my top five or my top six. And it's like, wow. And that happens. You never see it. Yeah. You never see it coming. It just sort of happens. I got really fortunate, and luckily I had the right talents and the right background to do it. And there was like, and Sven's like, yeah, come along, you know, let's do it.
That's awesome.
And so I did it, and then it just works out really well. And so, yeah, I'm biased, but also not, if you know what I mean. Like it started with the love and then came employment. It didn't start with employment and then they forced me to love them. so it truly does come from the bottom of my heart that I think, you know, all of these games, except maybe Divinity 2, which I wasn't as much of a fan of. But otherwise, all of these games are fantastic. And I think Original Sin 2 is going to be truly phenomenal. Like, I'm really excited to see what everybody thinks. You can go and play the early access bit, but I don't think people really understand how much changes in the final run towards release. And I think even people that play early access and was like, and think they know more or less what's up, I don't really think they have a clue just how good it's going to be. I really believe that is coming from Kevin, the person helping to make it, as well as Kevin, the person who plays a lot of games.
I can't wait to play it. Like, it is definitely on my list. As soon as it comes out, I'm all over it. It's been super. As soon as you announced the job that you took, it was just like, man, that's perfect. Like, that is the ideal pairing, because I know how much you had talked about, how much you loved Original Sin, and how much you've talked about Divinity games in the past. So, Kevin, it's been awesome to catch up and hear about how amazing all of this is going. I would love to have you back on when the game is actually out. I can get Nick Capizzoli on this podcast. We could both just have like a podcast review of Divinity Original Sin while you're here. It'll be like totally amazing. I can't wait to see the game, its reception, and I look forward to talking to you again soon.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Josiah. Always, always, always good to talk to you.
All right, great. Thanks again, everyone, for listening. Hopefully tune back in for the next episode of the 1099.